Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
How could the lowly little chickpea be responsible for a contentious and often controversial battle over national ownership of a dish? We'll talk about this and a lot more today on A Taste of the Past. Hi, I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. Indeed, the chickpea. It's created a battle, it's a whole other war, if you will, the hummus war, which has been waging, I guess, for the past 5 years or more, Lebanon wanting to lay claim to the dish, and, of course, so many Arabs living in Israel, they believe it's their dish as well. Well, we'll try not to get in too much to the political aspect of it, but indeed, it opens up a whole other question of food copyright, of authenticity, food and identity. And here to talk with us about that, the larger questions, as well as the hummus wars, is Ari Ariel. Ari is a Darot assistant professor in the Department of Hebrew and Judaic Studies at NYU, focusing on ethnic, national, and religious identity among Middle Eastern Jewish communities in the Arab world and Israel. And Ari just wrote a very good article on the hummus wars in the spring edition of the magazine Gastronomica, the Journal of Food and Culture. And I'm very pleased that he's with me here today. Welcome, Ari.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So when did this whole battle about hummus and who owns the dish, when did that first arise?
Well, it's an older battle than that. I think since the it's part of the Arab-Israeli conflict. So for years, there's been a battle over falafel, for example,
yeah.
Which sounds
tabbouleh,
a little ridiculous.
Right? Baba ganoush.
Yeah. But a few years ago, it really became an issue over hummus. Mostly, I think, because hummus is a sellable product. You can put it in a package. It's easy to export. So it became a more serious battle than the others. It
became a financial matter then.
Yeah, it became an economic matter for sure. It started in some way because a Israeli company sponsored a competition to make the largest dish of hummus in the world, around 900 pounds, if I remember correctly, mm-hmm. the first one. And Guinness World Records went to Jerusalem and certified it as the largest in the world.
I guess that raised some hackles.
Exactly. That was the spark that set off the problem.
So who owns the title? I mean, I know the title went back and forth. You know, it was this competition, and they didn't wait for an annual competition. It was like every 4 to 6 months or something, someone was trying to make the largest dish. Who owns the title now?
So at the moment, Lebanon owns the title, and the largest dish was around 25,000 pounds.
25,000 pounds, if someone once said in some blog, do they realize it would take a pea to the size of the Dead Sea to dip into a bowl that big?
People always ask me if they ate it, and they did actually eat the hummus. It didn't all go to waste, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure there was some waste, but right. It was eaten.
Yeah. Well, interesting battles. But it actually goes deeper than that. I mean, this the battle with who can make the largest dish, that's the fun side of it. And, you know, it's always fun to take these food issues to another level. But there is a more serious issue, and that is the issue of copyright. Tell me about that. Copyrighting food or a dish is a huge question. We know it's been done, but tell me about that.
Well, in this case, the Association of Lebanese Industrialists organized an attempt called Hands Off Our Dishes to trademark the names hummus and others like baba ganoush and a few other dishes in the European Union so that only they could sell dishes. They could only sell a packaged product called hummus in the EU. They did not go far enough. They didn't actually succeed in filing the paperwork, so they don't own that trademark, but that was their campaign. And again, that's largely an economic matter. I mean, at the moment, two large companies dominate the world hummus market, as crazy as that sounds. And they're both Israeli, or at least Israeli in origin. Now they're both owned by multinational corporations.
Well, I know Sabra is one of them that's mentioned often.
Yeah,
in the
Sabra
articles.
is,
we see that in the grocery stores in the United States,
sure,
all over the place. Right.
That's now the world's largest producer of hummus. But they're actually owned at this point by Pepsi, or at least a majority of the company is owned by Pepsi.
Who's trying to improve their health image.
Yes.
Snack foods. So that was a good move on their part, I guess. Well, it's interesting that, I mean, the war, as we call it, you know, is one where, you know, it's a battle between chefs and hopefully nobody gets hurt and it's all in fun. And it's interesting that Lebanon should try to claim it as their own. I mean, it is... It's an Arab dish. I mean, chickpeas have been around for as long as we have any history whatsoever. Tell us a little bit about what we know about the background.
Well, we think the first domesticated chickpeas, they were first domesticated about 7,000 years ago in Western Asia, so in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And then they spread from there and spread pretty quickly to the Mediterranean, to other parts of Asia, and then to the New World. So now they're pretty much every place. There's no place without chickpeas.
Right.
We don't know a lot about the history of the dish, hummus. I mean, it's natural to puree something or to mash it up. But we don't know exactly when it started being mashed up with sesame paste, mm-hmm, and with the other ingredients. Hummus, it's worth saying, the word hummus is actually just the Arabic word for chickpea. So okay. It doesn't actually mean a particular preparation.
Mm-hmm.
And we start to see some
So the actual dish was in Arabic was called hummus.
So it's actually called hummus bit tahina, which
is right.
Hummus with tahini, right, which is sesame paste. Mm-hmm. We don't really know when that emerged. There are no Arabic language cookbooks from about the 14th century until the late 19th, early 20th century. So we know that before that, there were mashed chickpeas. And we know that in the 13th century, for example, I think I give a short excerpt of a recipe, which is chickpeas mashed with sesame paste, but with lots of other stuff in it. So
and vinegar in particular. Which
yeah.
We do lemon juice with it,
right.
Today's recipe. But.
And also a lot of nuts, a lot of different spices.
Right.
So it becomes a very
right.
different type of dish.
Right. It sounded very good. I'll find that in the article. We'll have time. We'll read that.
I've actually made that several times, and it is pretty good.
It sounded more exotic because of all the different spices that were in it and the nuts. Well, I know that there's mention of chickpeas in, I don't know if the cuneiform tablets actually mention chickpeas per se, but certainly in around Mesopotamia, the Epic of Gilgamesh from like the 18th century BC, they mention chickpeas. They are mentioned in that, in the tablets, as well as in a 14th century cookbook. Chickpeas are mentioned, but
right.
but as you say, not that specific dish.
Right. So we don't really know where that dish emerges or when exactly it emerges. It seems to be common by the modern period in the Levant as a whole. So,
mm-hmm.
And of course, the borders that we have now are all post-Ottoman borders. So really, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel.
Whatever they were at one time, they were all one and the same,
right.
You know, lumped together. So now we're, you know, Lebanon's laying claim to it's theirs alone.
That's actually the biggest legal problem with their claim is that they're not actually claiming there's anything unique about their hummus. So it's not that they're using particular chickpeas or that their hummus has a particular flavor. And they're also not claiming that it's not somehow also Syrian or Palestinian or Jordanian. They have a particular problem with it being Israeli, which of course is a political
right.
issue.
Right. Yeah, everyone acknowledges the fact that it is an Arab dish. You know,
right.
But you said something about unique, and I was just pulling a line that you mentioned in your article, is that it's part of a larger effort at preserving the imagined uniqueness of ethnic and national groups in the face of a perceived threat of others. And it's this whole amorphous, as you say, this amorphous concept of authenticity. And this has been certainly something that's come up in the show often, and that is what makes something authentic. And that is a very amorphous question, because I think we have to throw out, as we were talking before the show, throw out the word of authentic and deal with something else. You know, it's tough.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two issues here, really. There's a question of authenticity, maybe a psychological question of authenticity to self, And then there's the question of national authenticity.
Yes.
And that becomes much more difficult. Again, most of the borders, for example, in the Middle East are pretty modern. They're new borders. So nation states emerge, and then they each have to legitimize their existence in some way by claiming they're unique. Right. So as part of that, every nation seems to want to claim some sort of unique cuisine. And in this case, the Lebanese seem to be doing that with a dish that extends beyond their borders, which is the problem.
Mm. It's as I was reading the article and of course, over the years, you know, hearing, following it and, you know, in the news occasionally and kind of laughingly not knowing how serious this was becoming and how serious an economic terms it was becoming. In fact, I was talking to Andy Ahrens, one of the owners of Gourmet Garage yesterday, and told him what the topic was going to be for the show. And he said, "Ooh, I think maybe you're," when he said something, you know, treading on dangerous ground. They take their hummus very seriously over there. Well, and then I had to laugh at myself, thinking it's not laugh at myself, but laugh at the thought and the notion that it's. I likened it to an Italian, or more specifically, someone from Naples, telling the United States, where half of Naples at one time, you know, immigrated to the United States, telling them not to make pizza, that they were not allowed to make pizza, that they had the trademark on pizza. Well, we know that this has happened with other things in the past. Champagne in France, one is not allowed to make so-called champagne. They can make sparkling wine in the method of champagne, but only the wine from the champagne region, the champagne grape, can be called champagne. And then, as you mentioned in your article as well, the same thing was done in Greece, right?
Right, with feta. And the Lebanese keep saying that's the precedent for their case, that that the Greeks now own this trademark of the word feta, the title, the label feta on products in the EU. But in that case, they're actually claiming that there's something unique about their feta. They're claiming that their feta has a different flavor because of the milk that they use, that the grazing areas have unique flora in them, so that imparts flavor to the feta cheese. And they were also claiming that non-Greek companies were marketing feta by reference to Greece, by putting Greek flags on their packages and things like that, so that there was that infringement
also. Making people think that they were buying a Greek product.
Right, exactly. And they also claim that Greece produces and consumes more feta than anybody else. So they were really claiming that feta is somehow uniquely Greek in a way that the Lebanese can't really claim with hummus. But even in the case of champagne, it's clear that, well, one, it's an economic issue, but I think it also raises interesting questions of authenticity. Because we think of that as the most authentic and the most French products, right? But the stocks that those vines are on are American.
They're most likely American because of the disease, right?
So I don't know. With all these products moving around, I'm not sure what's left of authenticity if we really dig deeply into it.
And we might have to change that to unique. You know, replace authentic with unique and see where we come with that. Well, we're going to talk more about this issue in just a moment. We'll take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to discuss this a little further.
The program has been brought to you by Cain Vineyard and Winery. Cain Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cain5.com. Listening to right now is called Past the Hummus by Night Sun.
We are back with Ari Ariel talking about the hummus wars and the larger question of authenticity, food and identity, which we're going to get to, and uniqueness, and who really owns a national dish. Now, the question, getting back to the hummus wars, the dish, we don't know who and when who originally made it, when it was originally consumed. But then there's the question of Arab Jews and migration and foodways, migration of foodways. Well, the world has changed dramatically. Well, let's talk about, you mentioned something very interesting. You said migration provokes changes in foodways. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, America would have no cuisine, you know. So, yeah. I mean, how do we separate what is Arab food from what is Jewish food?
Well, I don't know. I don't even know if those are the right categories to
okay,
look at, right?
Good.
But in the case, specifically with the case of Israel, the whole country is an immigrant country, right? Mm-hmm. So obviously people are coming to what was Palestine and then becomes Israel from different places with different cuisines that are all mixing in a particular way. And they also find there a Palestinian Arab cuisine that they incorporate into their own as well. So I'm not sure if the question is really, did Jews from Europe start eating hummus because they took it from the Palestinians? I mean, of course they did, but they incorporated it in a particular way. And then at some point, does it become their dish? I mean, so the question is really, how do you indigenize a food?
Right.
And in the case of Israel, you also, of course, had lots of Jews from Arab countries moving to Israel, particularly after it's established. For the most part, they're coming from countries where hummus is not a major part of their cuisine, maybe not a part of their cuisine at all. Of course, there are some Jews that moved to Israel from Syria and from the surrounding areas, but most of them are coming from places where hummus is not a major part of their diet, but they much more quickly adapt to it.
Who doesn't like hummus?
Yeah, who doesn't like it? And it's much closer to the flavors that they're accustomed to than maybe for Jews from Poland or Lithuania, right?
Totally different diets, right?
And they therefore can adapt it much, much more quickly, and it becomes a major dish on menus in Middle Eastern Jewish restaurants in Israel.
Huh, interesting. So, I mean, it really is, you think of migration and foodways and what are national dishes, and it gets very complicated again. And I think that we have to rethink who's, you know, who lays claim, who has ownership of a particular dish.
I mean, I guess the other thing that's probably worth saying is that there is no Middle Eastern Jewish cuisine until all these different groups of Middle Eastern Jews got together,
right?
There's a Yemeni cuisine, an Iraqi cuisine, and a Moroccan cuisine, and a new cuisine forms from those in Israel because of the mixing of these new immigrants.
Right.
And it expands then from Middle Eastern Jews to Israeli Jews more generally. And I think as part of that, hummus does become part of that national cuisine in a way. That doesn't mean it's unique to Israel,
right,
but I think it is an indigenous part of it. It's the way Israelis eat.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the way they eat, and you said that you've recently started teaching a course called Food and Identity.
I am. I'm teaching a course this semester on food and identity. I taught it once before, in fact, and one of the major goals, at least for me in that course, is to get students to do away with this notion of authenticity, to stop asking about authenticity and to hopefully question whether that's even a reasonable category by which to assess foods.
And you tell them to look at what?
Well, I don't know that I'm always successful, but I tell them to look for hybridity, which I think they get very mm-hmm. quickly because, of course, we're in New York. A lot of them are immigrants themselves or children of immigrants. So they're aware that there's this hybridity, but they're looking past the hybridity and looking for authenticity behind that. And I want them to realize that the dishes that they think are authentic are also hybrids. They're just hybrids from an earlier period of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were talking about earlier before the show about Italian dishes. It came up. And you brought up a very interesting point. What is an Italian dish if you eliminate things from the New World or things that are imported, some of their wheat, for instance, to make pasta, the tomato from the New World to make the tomato sauce. So, you know, you have to really stretch a little further. Of course, you go to Roman times, and then the whole empire was larger, and you're not talking about what is Italy today.
Right, which reminds me that Italy is only 100 and something years old, 150 years
That's
old.
That's right. So. That's right.
So what does it mean to be Italian? That's really a modern concept.
It is. And the world has become such a small place, you know, that we are all sharing different dishes. I mean, in the I don't know when exactly hummus, baba ganoush, tabbouleh, it became super popular, I know, for me and my peers in the 70s. It just, 60s and 70s, it became, you know, wildly popular to have these dishes. Well, travel. Travel, you know, was more popular than airlines were taking us across the ocean in the 60s. And we were bringing back other dishes and we were being introduced to different foods and things. And so suddenly, the world culinarily was a small place. We were all sharing each other's cuisines. And it's kind of a wonderful thing. And I think that, yes, we can identify certain dishes as being perhaps originating or being unique in some form to a particular place.
Right.
But how they are then incorporated into our diet is, you know.
The other thing that I think is important to point out is that we do have this, all this movement. We have a modern form of globalization. But that's not new. I mean, dishes and people and cuisines moved always. So maybe the pace of that movement is a little faster now than it was a few hundred years ago. But that movement and that hybridity is not a new phenomena at all.
Right.
I mean, and I think it's also important in terms of authenticity because we have this fear, and I think this is part of what fuels the hummus wars. We have this fear of globalization, meaning homogenization, which means that then all of our local cultures and cuisines are going to disappear. Mm-hmm. But that never seems to be true. It seems, in fact, like globalization produces a new creativity, which produces new local cuisines, not homogenization.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that that's part of the whole identity thing, that people want to hold on to something that they feel identifies them as a culture?
Yeah, part of it is culture. Part of it is that the idea of nations has become so predominant that we feel like we belong to nations and then we have to legitimize them by looking for some sort of uniqueness. But also when we're looking for authenticity in other groups, that in fact is a way of saying that we're different also, that we also have our own authentic culture. So So I think it is. I think it's part of a fear that we're losing authenticity.
Mm.
I just don't think it's true.
Yeah, but, right.
Yeah.
And then we're hard-pressed in America, particularly to think, well, what's authentic to America?
Yeah, I was thinking about that this morning. I wonder how different this conversation might be if we were having it in Europe or someplace else.
Right.
I think here we all instinctively understand that nothing is really authentic.
Interesting. Well, tell me, I still see Sabra on the supermarket shelves. So obviously these wars are not over. Or they're on hold for the time being.
Yeah, there are two aspects of it. One is the largest dish in the world, which at least for the time...
That's the fun part of it.
That's right? The fun part, although what's interesting is that the language in that is so military, right? The language, yeah. Everybody's talking about that as a conflict or of weapons of mass consumption, is one of the quotes. But
well, I have something here that I pulled from something that it's a war on a less destructive front, and what do they say? They say, yes, it's a laughably, that the, as I said before, the soldiers wear chef's outfits instead of camouflage, and the slogans are hollow, as they say. Come fight for your bite, right? You know you're right. Well, we...
Maybe it's less destructive. I'm not sure, though. I mean, certainly it's not killing anybody, but it is part of the military conflict in a way, or part of the national conflict. And there's this idea that floats around every once in a while that by sharing foods we can reconcile, and that somehow is going to, you know, universally bring peace. It's the same idea of the Olympics, right? That somehow expressing our conflict in this game is going to...
Something that's common, a commonality,
right,
is the food.
But it doesn't seem to be true. It seems like anytime there's competition, it actually is part of a larger conflict. It doesn't actually mitigate the conflict. So,
indeed.
Unfortunately, indeed, That's not the case.
Yeah. Well, in these battles of who can build the largest sandwich, you know, they go on in all kinds of things, but never with such intensity because of national identity and ownership.
Well, except that the I can't remember his name right now, but the Japanese guy that kept winning the Nathan's hot dog competition, that seemed to irk a lot of Americans.
I'm not aware of that one. Tell me that one.
Okay, well, so every year Nathan's has this competition to see who can eat the most hot dogs. And it had, for a long time, always been won by an American.
Oh, the guy who ate the most hot dogs.
Right.
Yes.
So this guy whose name I can't remember, I'm blanking on it, who was Japanese, won several years in a row.
Yeah.
And that caused some disturbance among Americans that we had lost the competition. I mean, you would think, who wants to be known for eating the most hot dogs in a short period of time? But that took on some sort of national political level as well.
A loss of national pride. Ooh. I could think of better things. Well, I think that I don't know if we are going to see more of this food trademarking. I mean, when you think that it is impossible to copyright a recipe because you change an eighth of a teaspoon and it becomes someone else's recipe. You can copyright names. And then again, it's almost laughable because the names, the English word hummus, which you mentioned, comes from the Arabic, which means chickpea. Actually, it comes from the Turkish hummus, which means the hummus food dip, which originally came from the Arabic, meaning chickpea. But that the spellings are all over the map. So are they going to trademark a Roman alphabet spelling of hummus? I mean, we've got, you ask anyone how it's spelled
hundreds of different answers.
See it on a menu. And every menu you look at, it's spelled differently as well.
It's a real problem with their case is that it is a dish. It's not an ingredient. It's not a particular, it's a little easier with something like a cheese or a wine where the whole process is more controlled.
Right. Made from a specific, as you said, specific milk from a region and.
So they can't claim all of it. And in fact, the chickpeas are imported all very frequently. So it's not even clear that the chickpeas would be Lebanese that they're using. Mm-hmm. So their case is really problematic. And for that reason, it hasn't left Lebanon yet. They never actually filed the papers with the European Commission. So I doubt they'll do that. So Sabra will stay on the shelves for a while. And even if they got this trademark in Europe, I'm not sure how it would apply exactly to the U.S. But the legal battle would be really problematic. And now, in fact, Sabra is owned, I said, mostly by Pepsi. And I think Osem, the other major Israeli company, is owned mostly by Nestle. So it would be a huge legal battle involving lots of legal teams.
Indeed. Well, it's interesting to follow, and interesting that it's come down to food and who owns a food right and copyright. It's interesting. What migration, what do you bring with you? Something that reminds you of home. And so you bring a dish that is comforting to you, comfort food that you ate growing up, that is from your region.
Right. And of course, migration does provoke these changes in food ways, but it doesn't mean that you completely abandon an old cuisine and take on a new one.
Right.
So you always get these interesting mixes of cuisines and interesting meal structures, right? Krishnendu Ray, for example, at NYU, mm-hmm. one of the things that he's big on is that breakfast somehow is the first meal that changes. Right. So you have different changes happening in different ways, and this is just, I think, one of them.
Right. Right. And change, migration provoking change in the food ways also means just bringing food, old food ways to new worlds, which I think is wonderful. And we'll see where it leads us.
We shall see.
Right. Well, Ari, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Ari Ariel, and talking on the hummus wars. And I hope you'll join us again.
Thank you.
Next on A Taste of the Past.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.